thank you for listening to the Packet Pushers Podcast, a program about data networking for nerds by nerds. I am Ethan Banks, podcast host at EC Banks on Twitter. With me, as usual, is Mr. Greg Farrow at Ethereal Mind. We have a sponsored show today where we will discuss the data center switching solution put forth by Plexi. With us from Plexi is Director of Product Management, Martin Terpstra. And Martin, why don't you introduce yourself to the folks and give us a little bit better of an idea of what you do at Plexi.
Thank you, Ethan. My name is Martin Terpstra. As you mentioned, I am Director of Product Management for Plexi. Plexi is a startup that's been around for a couple of years now, coming up to 2 years. And my responsibilities are mostly around the requirements definition and solution definition of the overall solution, and very specifically the hardware switching platform within our solution that hopefully we will discuss in a few minutes.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing stopping us from getting into it now, because your hardware switching solution is a little bit different. I mean, on the front end, it is an Ethernet switch of various densities, but there's more to it than that.
Yeah, there absolutely is. Plexi is a company that's set out to look at, you know, data center networks. We've been building data center networks pretty much the same now for the last, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And while the switches that we've used have changed, you know, the port densities have changed, the speeds have changed, which has allowed us to, you know, perhaps go from what used to be a 4-tier network to a 3-tier network to even to a 2-tier network, or interesting variations of those networks, we still build networks the same way. Plexi as a company really set out to, can we change the way we build a network, where we've always built networks in a fixed size and then try to sort of adapt how applications use the network based on that fixed network. Could we do this the other way around? Could we have the applications dictate what kind of network it is that we need, and can we then actually build a network dynamically, reconfigure or create a network that matches what these applications are looking for? So you're right. Our switch has, right on the front end, it looks like a typical top-of-rack switch with 10 gig Ethernet ports, 40 gig Ethernet ports, etc. But it has some special things in there to allow us to change the way switches are connected together. We have some WDM optics and cross-connect technology built into the switch, which allows us to take the way the switches are connected together. They're wired with some MTP fiber cables in a ring topology, but on top of that ring topology, we can actually use CWDM technology to connect these switches in not a completely arbitrary mechanism, but we can change the way which switches are connected to what other switches and in what capacities, driven by what applications are looking for, what kind of bandwidth do they need, and what kind of connectivity do they need between the applications, between the switches.
That's a concept you got to expand on, because it took me a little bit to get this through my head. I've been talking with you guys off and on for several months now. The notion that you can take switches that are in a ring and still build effectively an any-to-any topology. I know it's not a limitless any-to-any topology in a Plexi ring, but effectively, even though the ring is built such that you've got an in and an out and one switch connects to another in the ring, as you're moving traffic around that ring, and step in when I'm messing up here, you can effectively skip a switch that's in the hop.
If you look at our switch, right, our switch has, we call the light rail interface, and that's really our sort of switch interconnect. It's a standard MTP cable, and every switch has two of these connectors, and one of those cables goes to, you know, my neighbor switch on the left, and one of those goes to my neighbor switch on the right, ultimately to form a ring of switches. Now, that's a physical topology. That's the physical fiber connectivity that we create between them. Now, on top of that, we build a WDM topology that terminates ultimately in 10 gig switch ports inside of the actual switch. Our sort of default topology, if you don't really change anything, because you can change that, but if you don't change anything, every switch has direct visibility or a layer one WDM connection to 5 switches to the left in a ring wise and 5 switches to the right. So we actually create on top of that fiber infrastructure, we actually put enough waves to one side and enough waves to the other side, light waves to the other side, to create 10 gig connectivity, switch connectivity between the switch that you're looking at and 5 switches off to the left and 5 switches off to the right. It passes passively through the intermediate switches. So there is passive optics within each of the switches that it physically passes through. So you can actually turn those on, but, you know, that connectivity still stays in place. And that's how we, you know, build essentially a partial mesh topology, because it's obviously, it's connected in the ring. So depending on the size of the ring, you know, you always have, you know, that visibility to, you know, those five switches to the left and five switches to the right. And we create, for smaller rings, a full mesh between all the switches. And when the ring gets larger, obviously it gets to become a partial mesh between all the switches.
Let's go back to one of the original points you were making, which is you want to be able to take an application that has specific network needs and have that application drive what the network looks like, how it's behaving. So I think we kind of get the underpinnings with the, you know, Ethernet on the front end and the ring in the middle that facilitates partial mesh connectivity through waves. How then does the application take advantage of that infrastructure to drive what the network might need to look like?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So if you look at the switch, for us, the switch is a tool, right? So the switch itself and you know, the ring and the topology that you can build on top of the ring simply provides us the capability to build a flexible network where switches can talk to each other in not a completely arbitrary fashion, but in a partial or full mesh mechanism. That's only useful if you have a mechanism articulating what kind of connectivity do you actually need between the switches. And it comes back to our original point, which is really the starting point of the entire solution. We want to have applications tell us what it is that they're looking for from the network. We've termed the notion of affinity networking, and we've created this thing called affinities. And really, affinities are an expression of applications that run on a data center network and an articulation of what kind of network requirements do they have between themselves. And not so much network requirements as in, you know, this many megabits or gigabits or those sort of things, but at a slightly higher level. I can create these concepts of affinity groups, and affinity groups are nothing more than a set of applications initially articulated by their MAC address, a set of applications that live somewhere within that data center network, and I can create a link between them. And by creating that link between them, I create an expression of saying, like, these applications talk to each other, and they have a certain network sensitivity. And a sensitivity is something like, right, they're sensitive to bandwidth. As in, these applications are likely to consume a lot of bandwidth. They may be sensitive to hop count, as in, for optimal performance of these applications, they will perform best if the connectivity between the applications has a minimal amount of hop count.
You know, hop count as in even traversing another switch, which might introduce sub-millisecond additional latency. You know, that kind of, those sort of concerns you can bake into the affinity group.
Exactly, right? So they're fairly high-level abstracted articulations of what that kind of traffic between those applications is sensitive to. Now, those articulations of what are those groups and how what do these groups want from the network between each other gets essentially fed to our controller. We have a software controller that runs as a VM, as a generic application somewhere. It takes all that input, and it takes essentially an inventory from the network switches, and understands, okay, what switches do I have? Where do these applications live? It makes a correlation between, you know, MAC addresses that have been articulated as an affinity, MAC addresses that are learned on the network, and creates an articulation of, okay, I now know where those applications live. And based on that information, it tries to create the best topology to satisfy the requirements that we've articulated, right? So we've articulated this set of affinities, a sense of sensitivities between these applications, and the controller will go through a whole set of algorithms to figure out what is the best way for traffic between all these applications based on, one, the topology that I have in terms of the switches, where these applications live, and what you've articulated as a need. The controller does that calculation, and essentially, you know, based on all the paths, because if you look at the switches and they, you know, they're partially meshed together, there's a tremendous amount of paths between any two switches. Not just a direct path, but also indirect path between switches are part of the consideration of how they get traffic from, you know, one switch to another switch. And the controller does the calculation. It figures out, you know, for each one of these defined affinities, what is the best way to get traffic from where it's coming from to where it needs to go to, and provides that information to the switches. So it essentially downloads topology information, forwarding topology information to the switches, and essentially tells them, if you get traffic, this is where you should forward it. It's calculated the end-to-end path for all the traffic for which we've articulated in Affinity.
Therefore, this is truly a software-defined networking solution. Not only is there's a central controller that understands its topology and then does an end-to-end creation of a path for a particular, I guess in your lingo, an affinity group to follow.
Correct. You're absolutely correct. The controller is there to calculate the best forwarding topology from anywhere in a Plexi network or a Plexi ring or multiple rings, from any place to any other place. And it essentially does the calculation based on the affinities that you've articulated and provides that to the switches. The switches then independently do their forwarding. Because we have a centralized controller that creates the topologies, calculates the topologies, and then provides it to the switches, it is truly a software-defined network. There's a difference, though, here between a more traditional open flow-based SDN. Our controller is not in the data path. So right, new flows and everything else, the switches are completely independent in terms of their forwarding once they've been given topology. Topology covers everything, not just the affinitized traffic, but also the rest of the traffic. So the controller is really non-real-time sitting off to the side, providing topology calculations or the result of topology calculations to the switches. After that, the switches are completely independent in their forwarding of packets.
Okay, if I've got a Plexi ring and I have no controller, can I get traffic all the way around the ring without that controller at all? Or is there some initial topology that the central controller's got to do?
If you take a set of switches and you plug them in, you connect them into a ring, they will start to behave like regular switches, right? So they will learn MAC address. Obviously, you need to do some port configurations and some VLANs and those sort of things, but they will start learning MAC addresses. They will start flooding. They will start passing packets like you normally would. They behave like a regular switch. What the controller does is essentially optimize the topology, right, based on the traffic that you've articulated as an affinity. There's a second part to that. Traffic that's not articulated as affinity, so we call the residual traffic. The other traffic gets there. We also will load balance that across all of the available paths. I like to use the term non-equal cost multipath because that's essentially what it is. All of that traffic will be optimized by the controller. So you can almost see it as, yes, the switches are switches in their traditional form and they will forward packets, like any other switch would. The controller comes in and provides the switch with an optimization of the network topology and essentially tells the switch what the best way is to forward packets based on the inventory of all the links between the switches that exists.
Is there some sort of a bridge between the Ethernet on the front panel and the ring? In other words, this isn't all Ethernet. I'm assuming that obviously that ring is not Ethernet, or is it?
It absolutely is Ethernet. Right. So ultimately, within this switch, there is a switching ASIC, and it's a commercial switching ASIC like most other top-of-rack kind of switches have. And all we've done is we've taken a set of those ports from that commercial switching ASIC and tied them to our optical cross-connect and our WDM infrastructure to form that ring. But ultimately, they still terminate as a regular switch port in a commercial switching ASIC.
So that means that the Ethernet part is Ethernet like everything else?
It is. It is Ethernet as plain as Ethernet is. Right? So yes, over the ring, we use a proprietary transport, but on top of that transport, it is still Ethernet. And when it comes out of a regular port, Ethernet.
Yeah, that's not the end of the world because we're forever tunneling Ethernet over something these days. Sometimes we even tunnel Ethernet over Ethernet.
It's not actually a tunnel, right? It is... plain Ethernet directly on top of a WDM Lightwave, right? So it's there is no additional encapsulation. Right. It's just we've decided to pick WDM to transport because it's flexible and we can actually change the topology by changing where the Lightwaves are going, where they're terminating, and how they're cross-connecting.
So that's probably a good point. Maybe we should expose a little bit. A lot of the audience won't be familiar with how I don't think we need to explain the concept of wave division multiplexing as a, fundamentally a lambda or a light frequency can act as a channel for communication in the same way that a radio channel can act as a band for carrying Ethernet frames. So Wi-Fi carries Ethernet over a wireless channel and lambda carries Ethernet over a light frequency or a light channel. But how do we get the ring? Is the ring a circle from switch to switch or is it a bus
Physically, actually, is a ring, right? So whenever we talk about the ring, it really is only when we talk about the physical connectivity. Every switch has a connector or a cable going to the left and a cable going to the right to form a physical ring. Now, so physically, it's a ring, but on top of that, it is essentially a collection. It's a partial mesh. It is a collection of point-to-point, you know, Ethernet interfaces between the various switches that run across WDM.
So that means then, so now we have a ring, a physical ring of cabling going around a bunch of switches. So let's say there's four switches in a ring. But because I have multiple lambdas on the fiber, I can actually tune the lambda forwarding so that one switch is tuned into a given lambda and another switch is given it tuned into another lambda. And therefore, I've got a connection between those two switches.
Correct. If you don't change anything, because we do have the option to change sort of the standard topology, right? But by, and this is where I sort of started at the beginning of explaining the switches, by default, every switch will have a set of lambdas going to their immediate neighbors on the left and the right. And then you have another set of lambdas going to the next four switches on the left and the right. Direct, almost like point to point, right? Individual point to point circuits between that switch and my neighbors on the left side of me in the ring and on the right side of me in the ring.
But that's not visible to me. I don't have to panic about how that works. You have a software overlay that just says join this to this and this to this and.
You're absolutely correct, right? These connections, you don't have to configure them. You don't have to provision them. They get established. They talk amongst themselves across these links so they know who's on the other side. They exchange addresses. There's almost a sense of within the ring, the switches communicate amongst themselves similar to how line cards in a chassis-based system would communicate amongst themselves. They exchange information and they realize who is on the other side of the link, and that's how they ultimately create the topology that exists and provide that to our controller to say, here's the network that you can place network onto. This is the connectivity we have. These are the switches, and this is how they're connected.
Which is really flexible, right? Once you've got everything cabled in, out, in, out, in, out, and you go right around the circle, that means you can just say, you know, connect this switch to this switch, this switch to this switch. I want this sort of topology. Hang on, I want to change my topology. I can add another pathway from switch 1 to 3. And add in a sec, you know, I want another lambda added up to double the bandwidth between point switch 1 and switch 3. I just light up another lambda and I've got a second path.
Ultimately, you're absolutely correct. I mean, there are, of course, limitations because, right, there's only so many lambdas we can hand out any one switches, but you're absolutely correct. I can change the way switches are connected together. I can change what lambdas I use where, which allows us to change the physical, semi-physical, right, the layer one topology between switches based on what the applications are actually looking for.
Martin, you had said that the controller that does the topology analysis can therefore program the switches to behave in a certain way for certain applications. Okay. And then you said it's not OpenFlow that is being used to do that because the switches can also act independently, et cetera. So is there a role that OpenFlow is playing at all? And I'm curious to hear about that. And then I'm also curious to hear how is the controller talking back to the switches? My understanding is you've got some sort of an API of your own that you're using, right?
Yeah, and so from an architectural conceptual level, it is somewhat similar to OpenFlow, right? You have the controller that speaks to the switches. We've decided, since we're talking more than configuring of flows and flow forwarding, we're actually talking, we're exchanging topology information, right? We're giving the switches not just information about individual flows, we're giving them entire forwarding topologies, how to forward to any destination behind a certain switch, those sort of things. So we're giving the switches more, which is the reason why we don't use OpenFlow as the communication mechanism between the controller and the switches. So we have our own mechanisms to exchange that information to provide those switches with very explicit flow forwarding information for places where we've articulated affinities. For all the other traffic, we give the switches more topology information. We give them a view of the network, a forwarding topology of the network. So the interface between the switches and our controller is a proprietary interface. However, on the other side, talking to the controller, and our controller really is the central point of the entire network, right? This is where our configuration is done through there. Our articulation of these affinities that we've talked about is done through that controller. All the calculations are done there. It essentially determines what the network should look like and how traffic should be forwarded, besides the fact that the switches, of course, are capable of doing plain Ethernet forwarding by themselves. On the top of that, almost like on the north side of this entire solution, is an API. It's an API that we will publish, and it's essentially a REST or a Jython Java-based API that can be tied into any sort of provisioning system. We've built a GUI on top of that API for demo purposes, basic debugging, and those sort of things. But it's fully expected that people with fairly elaborate provisioning systems, rather than talking to each individual switch or having some other mechanism talking to the controller, we are fully expecting people to use these REST APIs to talk to the controller, to articulate these affinities, to configure the switches, and whatever else needs to happen. So that's our northbound API, if you wish.
In other words, it's a proprietary API, but it's not a secret API. You guys are publishing that the API methods, et cetera, so that folks can write their own applications as they like.
Absolutely. The power of all of this is exposing what the controller is capable of is exposing that. So those APIs will be fully published, and right, we totally expect people to either script against that or tie their existing provisioning systems against that, so that when they have information about what applications are running where in a, let's call it a cloud provisioning system, that pieces of that information can also be fed to the Plexi control application so that it can actually create an affinity to say, okay, once I've placed these applications, I've placed VMs somewhere in my data center, I can actually create an affinity between them. I can actually articulate that there are applications that need to communicate and how they need to communicate. So we fully expect, right, that API is going to be public. So we fully expect people to tie those into their provisioning systems or tie those into their script machines, the script fabrics that may also exist.
Can we get into a specific example of how a couple of hosts would communicate? In other words, a lot of folks that are going to be listening to this show are going to be really familiar with how an Ethernet network works. A host needs to talk to another host. If it's in the same local network, he puts an ARP on the wire, figures out the remote MAC address, frames it up, and out it goes, and it gets to its destination. Straightforward. And from what you're saying, out of the box, the Plexi solution for a layer 2 connection would work similarly. So what happens then if I am a host trying to talk to another host on a different switch hanging off the Plexi ring, and there has been an engineered path that has been put in place by the central controller because of a policy that's been applied to an affinity group? What is the forwarding process that happens as that frame makes it from endpoint to endpoint?
For traffic where we've specifically created affinities, I mentioned it very briefly earlier. We have two types of traffic. There is traffic that we've explicitly affinitized. This is the example that I'll walk through in a second that you asked for. I've explicitly articulated there is a set of applications on somewhere here on my network, somewhere there on my network, and I have engineered or calculated a path based on the constraints or the sensitivities between those applications. There's also, and that's probably a fairly large group, of what we call residual traffic. It is all the other traffic that exists on the network that I haven't explicitly articulated, but that I simply expect to forward layer 2 or layer 3 like a normal switch would. The treatment between those two is slightly different. So let me first start with the first one. If there is specific we call it affinitized traffic. So I've created the policy, an affinity policy between two applications, and ultimately those end up being an application running on a server here, an application running on a server there. For every affinitized traffic, there are very explicit TCAM entries that are being set up in each of the switches along the way. So packet comes out of the source application. I'm assuming we've done our ARP and those sort of things. So let me just get past that. The first application packet comes out, hits the first switch, hits a TCAM rule, and the TCAM rule that has been pre-engineered by the controller essentially said if this source, this destination, this VLAN, and perhaps a few other things, you match the packet, out it goes to a specific port on, let's call it the ring side or the fabric side of the switch. So it is a very manually engineered path, calculated path by the controller that intercepts the traffic with a TCAM entry and forwards it out a specific fabric port or ring port, or an uplink if you wish, to the next switch. Next switch, same thing. If it's not the destination switch, again, if it's an intermediate switch, it again will have an entry that looks at the packet, looks at the source destination to VLAN, matches it, and very explicitly puts it out the next link inside of the fabric, inside of the ring, until it ultimately hits the destination switch. Destination switch looks at this. Obviously, it's a local MAC address, and we'll spit it out the ports where the destination application lives. So that's for affinitized traffic. So affinitized traffic is very – it's handcrafted. They're handcrafted paths that are created through the network across the ring and explicitly forwarded at every step along the way according to the best path that we've calculated.
Now, is it radically different between layer 2 and layer 3 if it happens to be needing to go between VLANs?
No, it's not. Obviously, we're a young company, so our layer 3 affinities are coming, but there's no real difference. It'll end up being the exact same thing. We'll match on more things instead of perhaps matching just on source and destination MAC addresses. We'll match on IP addresses, source destination IP addresses, and you can think even further than that, matching on port numbers, et cetera. So in this specific example, for those that are familiar with OpenFlow, it is probably the most comparable with OpenFlow, and how OpenFlow would do very specific flow-based forwarding is a match TCAM entry, and you push it out a specific port based on whatever the action is that is provided as part of that TCAM entry.
Now, someone might have heard you go, well, layer 3, we're not doing that yet. We're still writing that code. Does that mean you can't route between VLANs?
Actually, this week, we are releasing our official 1.0 release. We've been running with some beta customers for the last 3 months now. Those have all been layer 2 deployments. Our IP forwarding code is currently under development and will be out. Christmas is the target, so very shortly after our first release, we will do routing as well between VLANs. But we started off with a layer 2 solution that's available today. The layer 3 routing is coming. Like I said, we're hoping to have that done by Christmas.
And then when you do the layer 3 forwarding, it's gonna the path that it follows and the way that it gets from point A to point B is going to be very much like the layer 2 path, analogous to how an OpenFlow record would read.
The method is going to be very similar, right? Again, it's going to be based on specific matches, and it's a very manually, not manually because it's not a person, but it's a path that is very carefully crafted for those specific flows by the controller and for the ones that we've created those affinities for. Now, I did mention previously, right, there is a whole bunch of traffic that you may not have explicitly, let's call it affinitized, let's make that a verb. We call it the residual traffic. There's no expectation within a Plexi solution that all traffic between any application is specifically affinitized. We're actually expecting that a large portion of the traffic is not affinitized and will flow fairly normal between switches. The real big distinction there, again, the controller has a part in that, because rather than having a normal sort of learning bridge network with spanning tree and those sort of things, inside of the ring where how the switches are connected, again, the controller creates the optimal topologies from any switch to any other switch, and it's a multipath kind of topology. If your ring is fairly small, there's a very good likelihood that any switch has a direct connectivity to any other switch. But you may also have indirect switches, right? If I want to go from switch number one, a source on switch number one, to a destination that switch sits behind switch number four, for instance, I can very likely directly forward it from switch one to switch four because I have a direct connection across my ring. But I may also go through from switch one to switch two to switch four, a completely legitimate path to forward the traffic, or from switch one to switch three to switch four. Now, all of those paths, right? So we're massive because of that partial mesh. We're massively multipath within our ring topology, and the controller essentially will pick a large set of, I call them earlier non-equal cost multipaths, and make those available to the switch. So we'll actually tell the switch, if you don't have an explicit affinitized flow that you're forwarding towards all the other traffic, here's the set of ways that you can get from yourself to any other switch, and here's how you should load balance across all of these. All switches are provided with that same sort of view of the topology, how to get from one switch to any other switch with the same load balancing rules.
So that's your own thing, across the ring, where effectively you're not wasting any of the available bandwidth. It's there, and therefore you can use it without having to custom build, LACP paths between switches or something like that.
You're absolutely correct, and it goes back to one of the value propositions that we're trying to get to is, whenever you build a data center network today, right, you either build it at a fixed oversubscription, right, 3-to-1, 4-to-1, or fairly common oversubscription. But it also means that if you have applications that, you know, want better connectivity than that over subscription, you can't get it. And of course, there's ECMP or lag kind of mechanisms by which you can improve some of that. But ultimately, you still build a fairly static 3-to-1 or 4-to-1 oversubscribed network. Conversely, if you build a 1-to-1 oversubscribed network, you're going to use a lot more switches. And yes, those applications that need that 1-to-1 will get exactly what they need, but you're very likely to have bandwidth, you know, sitting around not being used, because it's unlikely that, you know, all of your switches will always use all of the bandwidth that they have. So within the Plexi solution, because we are doing this massive multipath forwarding, we will actually make use of all of the available bandwidth that we can find. The affinities will drive us to the traffic that we care about the most. We'll find the most optimal path between any two switches. All of the other traffic will be load balanced across all of the other available paths that may be available between any two switches.
I think I'm getting the idea of how the traffic is flowing around the Plexi network. Some practical questions here. One is, what switch models do you have and where do they fit? Are these big core switches? Are these top of rack switches? What's the form factor and port density, so on?
We are releasing our first product, our first switch. It very much looks like a top of rack switch. It's a 1U high switch. It has on the front 32 SFP plus interfaces and 4 QSFPs, and in a variety of management serial and those sort of things. So it's a 1U box, dual power supplies, reversible fans, right, all the usual ones. So if you look at it, you would look at it and go, hey, that's a top of rack switch. The only thing that you'll find that's a little bit different, it's a little deeper than most top of rack switches, and again, that's because, you know, we have some optical components in there that take up some space. That's the current switch that we have. It's the only switch that we have, so it really is a top of rack form factor kind of switch. Where it would play in the network is, you know, that first top of rack and perhaps the aggregation tier, or collapsing those into one, is really where that switch is positioned. Over time, again, we are a young company. Over time, we will come out with different variations and different models. You will not see us go and try and tackle, right, the traditional core switch market. Right? So a large multi-slot chassis-based system, we're really trying to change the way networking is done, by having larger port density, smaller switches that are smarter in how they connect to each other, rather than
you don't need a core switch,
right,
do you?
Right.
Your core switch is not relevant because you don't need to have a big fat connectivity plane in the back. So normally you have a big core switch, you have your top of rack, boom, 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 end of row, whatever it is, and then you, these days mostly end of row, and then you connect back to a core switch to connect the end of rows all back together. But if you've got multiple gigabits of bandwidth between the switches themselves that you can connect in any pattern, you don't need a core switch.
You're absolutely correct, and I'm happy that you just said that rather than me.
Well, I mean, it's obvious, right? The point of a core switch is to, for all the access switches to connect to. So it's a big, expensive, power-sucking monster that does this really high-speed forwarding, and your core switch is always, the arbitrary three-layer design that we've all had for the last decade. Is that, that core switch should be layer 2 forwarding only, and everything, lots of high density, high speed ports in it. But if you can connect all of your top of rack or end of row switches with a high bandwidth connection, and then arbitrarily wire the switches together to be talking to each other as needed, and then use layer 2 ECMP across that, then I just don't need a core switch. I can just have one core switch over here that connects to my legacy network, and then over here is my Plexi ring around these new racks. And that also means you don't have to forklift anything too. You can start with one Plexi, two Plexi, three Plexi, create the ring, and then hook one switch back down to the core, and then just progressively roll it out along your data center.
You got it spot on, right? It really is. Right? And even if in the more sort of advanced data center designs, right, the spine and leaf or some of the butterfly kind of designs, we're taking that one step further, right? Because even in those designs, there are no real core switches. Most of the switches that are being used are high density 10 gig 1U, 2U form factor kind of switches. We're taking that one step further and actually collapsing that into a single ring, a single layer, right, with very dense connectivity between them. So yes, you're absolutely correct. correct. We don't actually need, in this design, you don't need a core switch. In fact, we are the top of rack and the aggregation switch in one, and all you need is that core switch to connect to the rest of the infrastructure that happens to be there, whether it's to leave the data center for external connectivity, whether it is to connect to other parts of the data center. Right? But within the Plexi domain or the Plexi solution, there is absolutely no need for a core switch in its traditional sense.
So within that domain, then, how many flow entries can you support?
We're using commercial silicon. I mentioned that, commercial ASICs. The flow tables they're not fixed. They depend a little bit on how much you articulate. We essentially have the very same limitations that anybody else using this commercial silicon. We're using Broadcom. That's not a secret that everybody else has in an open flow kind of mechanism. And we're talking any one switch. Again, there's no fixed number because the size of the table is not necessarily fixed. But we're talking several thousands specifically forwarded flows. Can be kept by the switch at any one time. And obviously you can rearrange that and cache those out and in and out, but the commercial ASIC will support, I want to say, several thousands. It's probably sort of the 4,000 or 5,000 kind of range, depending a little bit on how much information you're trying to match on.
In the companies that you've been doing your beta testing with, what's been the use case that you've seen? I mean, I can see financials, especially people that are looking for extremely low latency environments and looking for a lot of flexibility and design, gobbling this solution up. And assuming I'm right, what else? Who else is keen on this?
For the financial companies where latency comes at a latency is part of the value proposition that they have as in their offering, being able to collapse multiple layers and creating a highly dense, you know, directly connected network takes significant latency out of that, and that's part of the value to them. What we've seen with some of the other customers that we're trialing with today. They're mostly cloud providers, public cloud providers, and someone using them in, you know, a fairly traditional top of rack, create a ring, have all the servers and storage connected to that, and they're using it as their sort of rack infrastructure where they've affinitized. There's one customer, for instance, that is affinitizing iSCSI traffic. They have several centralized iSCSI arrays, and they've specifically, you know, affinitized traffic to and from those arrays.
Now, affinitized it for what? Because that's a real interesting application. Affinitized it for no packet loss? What did they prioritize?
In this case, it was affinitized for bandwidth and low hop count. You can actually combine some of these things. So we will actually try and find the most available bandwidth with the least amount of hops through the network from an application to the storage array and back again. And what that will do is, you know, once those paths are being used, we model the traffic and we actually measure the traffic that is being used by this. All the other traffic will try and stay away from the path that's being used for this iSCSI traffic. So here was a combination of bandwidth and hop count.
So I didn't mean to derail you there, but yeah, okay. So we've got some guy. Well, that's a more of a traditional enterprise application. iSCSI traffic, very popular. And then back to other scenarios you're seeing in the beta testing.
So there's one more that sort of popped out, which was sort of a very interesting use case. Is again, it's a cloud provider, generic. It's you know, half host provider hosting, half cloud kind of services. They already have an existing infrastructure. They're putting a Plexi ring in addition to their existing infrastructure, and they're offering it as a premium service. So they're saying, if you want higher density, better connectivity between the VMs or your servers that you may, your hosted service that you may have, we will take your traffic and we will specifically affinitize it. We will give it preferential treatment over the Plexi network. So they essentially created a tiered service, network connectivity tiered service within their existing offering, and taking that traffic, putting it on the Plexi ring and affinitizing the traffic between them. So they've created themselves a premium service, a premium network connectivity within their normal cloud hosting offering that they had.
Yeah, the assumption being, are they doing that with their own orchestration software as well, or are they at least looking at that?
So yes, they are. So they do have their own orchestration software, and they're essentially they've attached themselves to our APIs for some of the basic configuration. But that's actually relatively straightforward. But for the articulation of those affinities, where do these applications live? How do I detect them? What do they need between them? And, you know, they're essentially have adjusted their provisioning system to talk to our APIs to actually do that provisioning.
Now, something else you had mentioned just a bit ago, you had alluded to someone who had an existing legacy network, and then they were bolting on a Plexi ring. So how does that work? How do you integrate with someone's existing network, since the Plexi ring is sort of a different animal?
The switches amongst themselves, obviously we have our own WDM-based connectivity between each other. But on the front side, you know, if you look at the ports, they're still Ethernet ports. We switch today, we will, within a month, we will do basic routing as well. You can connect these together like you would any other two switches, right? We have the 10 gig SFP pluses on the front or QSFPs, and you can simply interconnect switches together, take a Plexi ring, take one of the access ports and connect it to an existing network and essentially tie those two together. Obviously, you need to be a little bit careful with loops and those sort of things. But other than that, once you talk about those regular access ports, they are Ethernet ports like any other Ethernet ports. You know, we just happen to have some special sauce in the back end of how our switches communicate to each other. But on the Ethernet side, you know, it's Ethernet, it's IP, it does all the things that you would normally expect out of an Ethernet switch.
Can you do MLAG, multi-chassis link aggregation between two Plexi switches, either to connect outbound to the legacy network or upstream to a host?
I think this is actually a perfect example, and it's a good question, because this is one of those examples where, because we're a little different, we can do things slightly different as well. Traditionally, in MLAG, from the endpoint's perspective, it believes it has a lag with two or more links going out to the same switch, except that the switches it connects to on the other side happen to be two different switches, and MLAG is used to, you know, make sure that those two switches are synchronized. I mentioned it way in the beginning of our conversation that our switches actually talk amongst themselves inside of the ring. There is a control protocol that runs where they learn who's alive, who's on the other side, they exchange MAC addresses and those sort of things. So we have, within that communication that exists between our switches, it's not MLAG as per the official protocol per se, but you can most definitely multi-home either an endpoint, a server, a storage, or another switch. You can multi-home that to multiple switches within a Plexi ring, and we will realize that we have the same endpoint connected to multiple switches, and we'll be intelligent about how we distribute the traffic to that server or to that switch or to that storage array across those multiple links. So I prefer to call it multi-homing, because it's not really MLAG in its traditional MLAG protocol defined way, but it certainly is multi-homing from a specific device to multiple switches on a Plexi ring.
Martin, thanks for the discussion of the technical aspects of the Plexi solution here. So one other question that I had was, I believe you guys are involved in the ONF, right? I think I've seen the Plexi logo tied up there.
We absolutely are. We are a member of the ONF, and we are participants in the working group meetings, both, you know, online and in person when they happen. I mentioned previously, even though we don't use the OPLO protocol specifically ourselves, we are most definitely interested in, you know, the evolution of SDN in whatever form they take. The ONF is the place that is driving that from an industry perspective. So that we're involved with, you know, many things, IETF, NANOG, right? There's plenty of industry groups. And we obviously, you know, keep an eye on all of the ones that are technically applicable to us and that our customers have an interest on hearing from us or talking to us. So we are fairly well represented in the various industry forums that exist.
How can folks find out more about Plexi, and if they are interested in participating in beta or having you guys come out and do a demo, how do they get in touch with you?
Easiest way, as always, go to plexi.com. Our website is evolving over the next little while. You will see very shortly more and more information show up on our website, and it'll have all the links and all the pointers to getting in touch with the right sales engineering folks, the sales folks, demo presentation, you name it. Plexi.com is the place to go. Plexi with double X.
PLEXXI.com. Yeah, and we'll link to that in the show notes.
I think that Plexi's got an interesting solution here, in that it changes the way you look at your data center network or even a campus network. It's got some interesting solutions in a campus, but I don't think the initial that that's where it's going to be in the early days. That idea of being able to re-architect your backbone on the fly for certain financial applications where you can take a network down in the evenings and have very low-risk changes is really fascinating in the way that it could change your change management process. Like you could, today we have problems with Ethernet because spanning tree everywhere, and every time we make a change in our backbone, that's a problem. Now, this architecture from Plexi takes away a lot of that pain, and you can do some quite interesting things around that. So it's an interesting way. I like to see new ideas coming to market, and people should take the opportunity to look them up.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to the show this week. And you can follow the Packet Pushers on Twitter at Packet Pushers. And, of course, packetpushers.net, as most of you that listen to the show are going to know, packetpushers.net is where home base is for us. That is where the blogs are, and all of our podcasts are online there. You can listen to them. We haven't taken any of them down yet, all the way back to the beginning, if you care to. Our RSS feeds are there, and link to the new forum site is there, our IRC channel, and so on. If you have any questions or comments, send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.